Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Wednesday, October 1st, and I'm Nat Cardos reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Fortuna City Council freezes mobile home park rent hikes, government shuts down after Congress fails to reach agreement on spending bill, Arcata City Council increased security after a weapons scare. So stay tuned, those stories and more coming up.
Redwood Community Radio acknowledges that its transmitter sites are located on the unceded territory of the Tsingkiyon, Wailaki, Wiyot, Wilcut, and Kato people. We honor ancestors past, present, and emerging, and acknowledge the ongoing cultural, spiritual, and physical connection these tribes have to this region.
The Fortuna City Council is moving closer to enacting mobile home rent control with approval of a rent increase moratorium. Daniel Mintz reports.
Responding to emotional pleas from residents of Fortuna's largest mobile home park, a majority of city council members voted to freeze mobile home rent increases, despite what a staff report describes as high likelihood of litigation. By approving a rent increase moratorium at a September 29th special meeting, the city council moved closer to the ultimate goal of establishing a mobile home park rent control ordinance. That was to the delight of residents of the Royal Crest Mobile Home Estates Mobile Home Park, who have been lobbying for rent control since mid-July. City Manager Amy Nilsson presented a case for the moratorium and the eventual ordinance.
The findings that constitute the basis for the urgency and the need for a temporary moratorium include all of the items listed on the slides, but a few of them are: mobile home parks provide an important alternative form of housing. A significant majority of the residents of mobile home parks in the city are older individuals or couple living on fixed income. Nearly all mobile home park residents own and occupy their mobile home and have made a substantial investment to live in the mobile home park. And residents of a mobile home park have very limited mobility due to the impracticality of relocating a mobile home. A number of residents of mobile home parks in the city have expressed the concern that they could become homeless if mobile home park owners continue to impose significant rent increases. Temporarily pausing space rent increases will prevent, again, rush space rent increases before adoption of regulations to stabilize mobile home space rents.
But in a September 25th letter, an attorney for the park's investor owners warns that issues around rent control can, quote, result in litigation lasting many years, leading to, quote, unwanted stress and expense for all concerned. According to a written staff report, cumulative growth in rent at Royal Crest rose from $419 in 2012 to $822 in 2025, a 96% increase over 13 years. But in his letter to the city, Royal Crest's attorney argues the staff analysis is incomplete as it doesn't figure in Royal Crest's expenses, which he says have increased by 89% since 2013, not including $892,000 for capital improvements. Royal Crest tenants told the council they're, quote, scrambling for aid while park owners continue to raise rents unchecked, and rent control, quote, gives this council, not out-of-town corporations, the authorities to safeguard Fortuna seniors and families. Royal Crest resident Lana Craig said council action is needed to rein in untenable rent increases.
Our SOS group is more than a few elders that you see here. The SOS group stands for seniors in Fortuna and really throughout America who are being forced out of their homes in these difficult times, and perhaps ending up on the street or lost in some crowded shelter. The short moratorium and the RSO will not recoup the last four years of over 20% rent increases, but it will be a large, welcome, and most appreciated respite to the gnawing constant fear of this happening again. As the roads diverge, it's up to each of us which road we choose. We hope you will choose the moratorium and vote yes for the RSO when that time comes.
Royal Crest's owners support an alternative the council has been presented with, but has chosen not to pursue a memorandum of understanding agreement, which would forge what the park's attorney describes as a cooperative long-term plan regarding rent increases. But there's disagreement on whether such an agreement would be binding, and a motion to approve the moratorium got 4 out of 5 council votes. The only dissenting council member was Abe Stevens, who explained his reasoning amid an interruption from the audience.
I think I'm probably inclined not to vote for the moratorium. Just want to reiterate that it's not because I don't sympathize with all the seniors. I think they are fighting for their livelihood and their quality of life and everything. I think just the process, I would have liked to have seen a good faith effort to try and negotiate with the management company. I know you guys have probably a good reason to be skeptical of whether that would.
They don't try.
Well,
they don't listen. They have 52 of these cars.
Okay. In any case, so I think my decision is not based on, you know, that, but more the process, and not at least giving them the, you know, the opportunity to negotiate.
The moratorium will be in effect until April 30th or until an ordinance is approved. For KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
As of midnight, October 1st, the government has shut down due to Congress failing to reach an agreement on Democratic and Republican spending proposals on Tuesday. Both proposals fell short of the 60 votes needed to pass. The Democratic plan, which aimed to reverse $1 trillion in Medicaid cuts and make Obamacare subsidies set to expire at the end of the year permanent, went along party lines in a 47-53 vote. The Republican proposal to extend government funding for 7 weeks received support from some Democrats like Senators Catherine Cortez Masto and Senator John Fetterman, as well as independent Senator Angus King. Despite their backing, the measure fell short with a 55-45 vote. Senator Rand Paul was the only Republican to oppose it.
Well, in order to come to the table, Republicans have to be here. They're not here. They're scattered across the country, across the world, maybe on some trips, on vacation. We're here ready to work. And that part's unfortunate. We want to avert the healthcare crisis that we know is coming. I appreciate you asking about possible legislation. The majority controls the floor. If Republicans want to put pieces of legislation on the floor, they can next week. We are saying, let's avoid this shutdown. Let's end this. And let's have conversations about what's necessary to fix this healthcare crisis that you've created. But we're not going to take pinky promises like Speaker Johnson hands out to his conference, you know, giving them, you know, select committees and other things. Like his word doesn't mean much to House Democrats at this point, after backing away from a truly bipartisan CR in December.
That was Democratic Senator Pete Aguilar at a news conference today speaking on the government shutdown. In the aftermath, Democrats and Republicans have pointed fingers to each other as for who's responsible. Here's Republican Speaker of the House of Representatives Mike Johnson with his reasoning for the shutdown from a meeting with the press this morning.
The sad thing about it is that every single bit of this was entirely avoidable. Democrats could have worked with us in a bipartisan manner to avert this unnecessary and very harmful shutdown. But instead, they did something that is rather shocking to us. They prioritized taxpayer-funded benefits for illegal aliens over keeping the government open for American citizens. They themselves position that as a binary choice, and it's patently absurd. Listen to what the Democrats are demanding. They demanded, in exchange for our simple, clean, 24-page bipartisan continuing resolution, the same one that Chuck Schumer and the Democrats voted for just a few months back in March. In exchange for that, they rejected it and they demanded something else. They wanted us to add over $1.5 trillion in new federal spending, paid for, of course, by hardworking American taxpayers, simply for funding the government at current Biden level spending levels. We are not going to do that. We can't do that. We won't do it.
Due to this shutdown, hundreds of thousands of government employees will be furloughed. Nearly 90% of the staff at the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency will be furloughed, with only 1,732 of the 15,166 employees reporting to work. The Department of Health and Human Services is furloughing approximately 40% of its employees after already rough staffing cuts earlier this year. The National Institutes for Health is furloughing 3/4 of its staff, and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention is furloughing 2/3 of its staff.
Members will make their own decisions on that. We're very mindful of how the shutdown affects government employees, people who work for the federal government, who have been furloughed, people who work here in the United States Capitol, people who work as vendors here in the Capitol as well. We know that this is a disruption to them and their families. There's no pride, there's no glee in that. The Constitution indicates that members of Congress get paid, and so that is the current law. Some members will take other positions to have their pay set aside for a moment of time. Every member will make their own decisions.
National parks will remain partially open during the shutdown, though National Park Service will furlough more than half of its workforce. According to a document released by the service, park roads, lookouts, trails, and open-air memorials will remain generally accessible to visitors. It is currently unknown how long this government shutdown will last. KMUD News will provide further updates as the story develops. Arcata City Council will be tightening up security at its public meetings following a September 17th incident when a member of the public was wrestled to the ground as he approached City Council members carrying a knife and a gun. KMUD's Sigurd Bjorn spoke to freelance reporter Ryan Hudson about the latest developments in this story.
During a September 17 Arcata City Council meeting, a man in the audience stood up and approached council members with what appeared to be a gun in his pocket. Before he got there, the man, Shane Scott Hogan, was restrained and wrestled to the floor by City Manager Merritt Perry, at which point law enforcement officers intervened and arrested Hogan. In addition to the gun Hogan had in his pocket, which turned out to be a Nerf gun, essentially a toy, he also had a butterfly knife and pepper spray on him, according to a press release from the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office. Hogan is known to have attended previous Arcata Council meetings, particularly when the subject of the homeless encampment known as the 40, where he dwells, is discussed. He was booked at the Humboldt County Jail and charged with 6 felonies and misdemeanors. That was 2 weeks ago. Since then, there have been developments in the story. We spoke to freelance reporter Ryan Hudson, who has been gathering new information about this incident. So Ryan, what is the latest on this story? Shane Scott Hogan was arrested and arraigned. What happened next?
He was fairly promptly bailed out. And so within a few days, friends of his had collected bail money to the tune of $1,000 and paid that for him to get released. So he's out on his own recognizance right now. And he only spent a few nights in jail, is my understanding, and has already had a court hearing.
And so what happened at the hearing?
He pled not guilty to all 6 counts, and I'll list them briefly. There's disrupting a public meeting, resisting an officer, assault and battery, a felon in possession of tear gas, which we know to have been pepper spray that was in his pocket and wasn't used. The felon part, felon in possession of a tear gas, that's in relation to charges stemming from an incident out of Fresno, allegedly resisting a peace officer there. In addition to that, there was possession of a switchblade knife and possession of drug paraphernalia. And we do specifically know that that was a cannabis pipe.
And I gather that the district attorney was somewhat surprised by a homeless person raising $1,000 in bail. What's the story there?
Being homeless, he doesn't have a whole lot of money to throw around. So friends did come together, is my understanding, and I have a couple people who have vouched for that, so I can say that that did happen. But at the hearing, the district attorney wanted to know indeed what was his financial situation, so requested that he file a form in order to put on the record what his occupation was, where he lives, how much he makes for money. And part of that is because they want to be sure that he does indeed deserve to have a public defender paid for by the state. So he has to prove what income he does or does not have.
You've spoken to Hogan both before and after the incident. What can you tell us about him and his possible motives that day at the city council meeting?
I don't know a lot about him personally, about his background. I know that he has done some advocacy in Eureka as well as in Arcata now in regard specifically to homelessness issues. He has been kind of living outdoors in this property at the O Street, 10th Street area. It's generally called the 40 by people who live out there. And I have done a lot of interviews out there, so I've come across him a few times. I will say he's always been polite and, you know, cordial, very quiet guy. His nickname is Hush out there, so that's sort of indicative of his personality. So this was surprising to people who are acquainted with him, is what I've been told. This incident just didn't seem like it was in character for him. I did go out and find him in the 40 out in Arcata after he had been released on bail, where we talked briefly about what happened and how he was doing now.
Did he tell you why he approached the council members?
Not so much. I mean, he did speak to me briefly about that, but I'm going to keep that off the record. Let his lawyers deal with that end of it. He thought it was amusing that he needed to file a financial statement and even joked with me that he offered the district attorney to come out and have dinner with him. Because, of course, his door was wide open, he said. So, you know, you get a sense of a personality, but also a sense of frustration for the circumstances of, you know, experiencing homelessness.
So Shane Scott Hogan is out on $1,000 bail. He'll need to fill out that financial statement. And then there is a jury trial set for November 17, which we will, of course, be following and reporting on. But a man approaching city council members with a knife, a pepper spray, and a gun, even if the gun turned out to be a toy, that's a scary scenario. Do you know if the Arcata City Council is changing the way they conduct public meetings in the future?
I did speak with City Manager Merritt Perry about that question. How does he feel about City Hall meetings going forward and generally with the current political climate? And he was apprehensive. He was not sure how they were going to make adjustments, but he did indicate that he wanted to tighten up security a little bit and just monitor particularly City Hall meetings where they expected there to be any kind of contentious public comment period. And Lieutenant Scown told me that he believed that this particular thing involving Hogan was an isolated incident, but certainly they would be assessing things going forward. And I do know that, for instance, this Wednesday's meeting, they are setting up new stanchions to sort of control the flow in and out of City Hall for public comment period specifically, you know, like you might see at a museum or at a TSA airport check-in. So people are going to be a bit more controlled in the way that they engage the city council, I think, at least in the immediate period going forward.
That was freelance reporter Ryan Hudson on the September 17 incident at Arcata City Hall. Ryan has done extensive reporting on the homeless encampment in Arcata, known as the 40, and you can find it on YouTube by searching for Humboldt Freelance Reporting. My name is Sigurd Bjørn, reporting for KMUT.
Turning to Mendocino, Willits City Council approves budget for the year and signs off on grand jury report that found a toxic workplace culture. Mendo Local Public Media's Elise Cox reports.
In Willits, the City Council has signed off on its response to a scathing grand jury report and adopted a new budget. Both decisions came during a sometimes strained 3.5-hour meeting last week. I'm Elise Cox, reporting for KMUD News and MendoLocal.news. The Mendocino County Civil Grand Jury issued a report in June with the primary finding that top management in the city of Willits had allowed a toxic and intimidating workplace to develop by failing to follow or enforce written policies and procedures. Highly qualified, dedicated employees were driven out. Those who remained had no process available to address bullying and harassment by top management, because there was no director of human resources and because of the fear of retaliation. Councilmember Jerry Gonzalez said the city had little choice but to accept those findings.
In essence, we did not interview the said employees because it was confidential, so we, in places where we found that we had to agree with that the grand jury found what they found, because we obviously didn't interview these employees ourselves.
The report also faulted the city for giving staff no safe way to file complaints. Willits has no human resources director or personnel director. A senior manager who might have filled that role themselves was also accused of toxic behavior. At the meeting, city employee Nikki Caldwell asked who the workers can turn to now.
So with this now being your response and everything that happened with the grand jury and so on, so where can the employees now go to talk to who? And where do we go with issues? Who has taken our concerns serious? So all the stuff that happened over the last 4 years is not happening again.
Okay, that's a very fair question. I appreciate that question. So one of the things that the city policy stated was that you talk to the personnel director. And we all know that the city right now does not have a personnel director. Yep. And the city, we are working on that to rectify the language in that. So the a person working in the personnel department, technician, or the city manager / interim city manager would be the correct person to talk to. Unless one of those two people is the issue.
Okay.
And if that's the issue, you talk to the other, and I will gladly, I mean, I'm just the mayor, but if any city employee wants to discuss a situation, and they come to me, I will direct them to someone they can talk to. I don't want to go outside the realm of legal basis here, but we want to make sure that the employees know that they do have the ability and the right to talk to somebody in a situation.
In addressing the city's response to the civil grand jury report, Mayor Tom Allman said that the senior managers referred to in the report but not identified by name have since left the city, and he suggested that chapter may be closed. Later in the evening, council members turned to the city's fragile finances. They approved a budget by a 4-1 vote with a $26 million budget authority. That's legal permission to enter into contracts, hire staff, and otherwise commit funds of up to $26 million. Councilmember Bruce Burton voted against the budget, citing its reliance on Measure K sales tax dollars. In fact, under the current budget, the City of Willits's general fund is balanced by a $2.1 million transfer from the Measure K fund. It is and it isn't a one-time transfer. The city's general fund is projected to run a structural deficit of $2.4 million a year. Financial consultant Andy Heath urged the council to act.
The city's general fund has a $2.4 million annual issue, which is just not sustainable.
Heath said salaries and benefits for the city's 63 employees account for 80% of the general fund costs, well above the 60 to 65% that's typical for a city of Willits' size. Either Willits needs to spend less, or it needs to find other revenue sources. Councilmember Gonzalez said he could only support the budget if staff comes back with the reorganization plan and possible cuts.
We're not ready for a motion yet, but my motion would include that we would pass this budget reluctantly, with the understanding that we would look at some cost reductions that the city manager use whatever resources he sees fit to look at revenue enhancements, reorganization of the way the city's doing. We obviously added more employees than we had before, and we may be on the assumption we could afford it, but we can't.
Former Mayor Matt Strong said she regretted that past councils were never given a true picture of the city's finances.
If I had known that the city was basically driving down a railroad track that was going to go over the cliff, I would have been very alarmed and I would have wanted to take action.
Burton warned the city is squandering public trust by continuing to use Measure K funds to close the gap, and he expressed frustration with staff for not recommending more cuts. But Councilmember Matthew Elanese defended staff. He said it took years to get into this situation, and it will take years to get out. Reporting for Cambon News and MendoLocal.News, I'm Elise Cox.
And in National Native News, Antonia Gonzalez reads today's headlines.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Across Canada, people mark the fifth National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, also known as Orange Shirt Day. Prime Minister Mark Carney reflected on the tragic legacy of the residential school system and talked about how his government is moving toward reconciliation. But as Dan Karpinchuk reports, the country's governor general says more work remains.
There were rallies, ceremonies, and speeches with, in many communities, a sea of orange shirts. And there were celebrations of Indigenous music, language, art, and culture. And most importantly, there was time to reflect on the past abuses of the residential schools. In Ottawa, at one of the events, Prime Minister Mark Carney addressed the crowd.
Truth is the foundation of justice. And the truth is, for more than a century, this country ran residential schools. Over 150,000 First Nations, Inuit, and Métis children were taken from their families and their communities, torn from their languages, their cultures, and their identities. On this National Day for Truth and Reconciliation, we honor survivors and the children who never returned home. We reflect on the devastating legacy of the residential school system. And we, as a government and as a people, we match remembrance with responsibility.
It's been nearly 10 years since the recommendations from the National Truth and Reconciliation Commission. There were 94 directives after hearing from thousands of residential school survivors who told their personal stories of pain and tragedy. Carney says his government remains committed to advancing the work of that commission. Governor General Mary Simon, who is Indigenous, says some progress has taken place, but much work remains.
Inequities persist, and we share a lifelong responsibility to address them. I have seen Indigenous people striving to heal while still struggling to meet basic needs. Too often, they lack access to adequate trauma-informed mental health support that honors their traditional healing practices. So today, I call on every Canadian to renew their commitment to reconciliation.
Simon says she sees a world where young Indigenous people can embrace being Canadian without compromising their identity. For National Native News, I'm Dan Karpinchuk.
In the U.S., Orange Shirt Day events also took place, including at Haskell Indian Nations University in Lawrence, Kansas. The university was originally established as an Indian boarding school. Current Haskell senior Denise Flores-Frazier gave out ribbons in remembrance of children who attended the Haskell Institute and never returned home.
We created pins with the names of each 150 children that were discovered here at Haskell Indian Nations University. We put out their tribes and a little website link so that people can find if they have a relative here or if they just wanted to know more information about some of the children here, like the ages that they passed or their time here at Haskell. We're also leaving notes so that they can write letters to them. They won't be left at the graveyard, and we're not reading them. We're just collecting them in case people have anything they want to say to the children.
The sorority chapter of Gamma Delta Pi hosted the event. Other events on campus included a remembrance walk and an open mic and panel night to provide people the opportunity to share stories. The National Congress of American Indians has a list of resources available for tribes and hosted a webinar this week ahead of the federal government shutdown to discuss tribal funding, Indian affairs, and critical services. Webinar speakers discussed contingency plans, saying most tribal programs will be impacted, which could include funding disruptions. The government shut down midnight on Wednesday. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Larry Lashley. And thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mintz, Sigurd Bjorn, Elise Cox, and Antonia Gonzalez. KMUD News is online, and you can find us on KMUD.org and now streaming on most podcast platforms, including Apple Podcasts and Spotify, where you can download our stories and newscasts for offline listening during your rural commutes. You can also follow us on social media. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707- 424-923-2605 or send an email to news@kma.org. Are you passionate about your community? Looking to report on what's happening around Mendocino? KMA News is looking for stringer reporters from the Mendocino area to cover local Mendocino stories that matter. Whether you're a seasoned journalist or just eager to learn, we'll help you get started. You'll get training, support, and a chance to amplify real voices from your community. If you're interested, email news@kma.org for more information. Redwood Community Radio, Inc. is funded by Press Forward, the national movement to strengthen communities by reinvigorating local news. Learn more at pressforward.news. Reporting for KMUD, I'm Nat Cardos.